Hello and welcome to the Inside Betting Podcast. My name is Matthew Trenhale, and in this episode, I'm going to be looking at a question from @LuckyAday from Twitter. And his question was about, could I do a piece on how to judge a judge? Now, this is in relation to my Judge of Judges Medium piece, where I talked about the concept of people who are possibly not expert enough at betting themselves to make a good amount of money, but make a career, if you like, out of evaluating how good at betting other people are and following their advice in order to make money. And that way, if you're a judge of judges, you can incorporate a fairly wide range of sports, betting angles into your portfolio. And you don't necessarily need to be that exceptional at finding edges yourself. And when evaluating how expert at betting someone is, there are quite a few pitfalls, quite a few nuances to it. And I'm going to say straight away that this is by no means the be-all and end-all of this subject. There will almost certainly be things that I say in this episode that people will disagree with me on. And there are certainly people who will fail in some of the criteria that I describe, I'm sure, but who are actually very competent at betting, and vice versa. But I thought what I would do is I would reference each of what I called the four pillars or the four types of judge, which were the judge of sports knowledge, the judge of market knowledge, the judge of stats or statistics and modeling, and the judge of execution. And I thought I'd talk about how to evaluate someone in each of these categories, whether it is in person or content that you see online or listen to on a podcast, certain things that you should be looking for, maybe thinking about, questioning in order to evaluate whether it seems like sound information. So if we start with the judge of sports knowledge, now we all know someone who is very knowledgeable on a given sport. They can rattle off wide range of statistics on that sport, historical team lineups maybe, tell you who won what for the last 20 years and so on. But in this case, we're looking for people with not just extensive sporting knowledge, but people who know how to apply that knowledge to betting. So one of the best examples, I suppose, of this would be anyone who is an incredibly avid watcher of any given sport and constantly refers to the betting markets in conjunction with their watching of sport, and they allow their opinions to be compared versus their expectations of the betting markets. And just their better understanding of the sport than the market gives them an edge. There is certainly a very large number of race watchers, for example. So there are some people who will create complex speed figures, possibly, or handicapping systems for horse racing. And there are others who will just watch an inordinate amount of races, whether it's in person or videotape. Sorry, that's really dated me, online recordings, and watching it back again and again to capture those little nuances that aren't going to be necessarily found in the race descriptions or in the Betfair SP or however else you may evaluate a horse's performance. And they may not know literally how to translate what they've seen into a set of odds, but it gives them a good sense of when a horse has overperformed expectations or underperformed expectations or got unlucky. These are the kind of things where they know full well that the previous few runs are going to influence the odds that that horse goes off at in its next run, and they will feel that they know what happened truly in those runs better than someone who has not actually watched the race. So how would I then evaluate someone who professes to do this, either professionally or makes a good amount of money out of it? Well, I would definitely be wanting to hear them talk of things that I, the layman, who doesn't watch a lot of horse racing, wouldn't have picked up on, or indeed the professionals in the studio or the commentary might not have picked up on. So if I was speaking again specifically to someone who specialized in horse racing, it would be a case of, can they, you know, do they genuinely spot when a horse has been ridden suboptimally tactically, you might say. I'm not talking about necessarily, not trying or something like that, or, you know, or jockey, but where the jockey's just got the tactics wrong and the horse hasn't been given the opportunity to ride correctly. Now, if someone can tell me, the previous three rides of that horse, in all three instances, why that horse did not get the run it needed, did not get to run the race that it could have done, and, you know, they could tell me that it went off at sixes, eights, tens, and now it's available at 12s, and there was no reason why this horse wasn't still the sixes equivalent of ability. It just had three unlucky runs. Then that immediately makes me think, right, okay, well, I can understand the logic behind what you've said. And it would seem that those are the kind of things that, while those little descriptions about a horse's run held up in or whatever it may be can tell you some, you know, if I'm assured that someone does actually watch as much racing as I think they are, say, for example, someone who works in a bookmaker or is part of their job to watch an awful lot of racing, then that can undoubtedly be a good angle, and it's worth noting. It's another thing, of course, when you've got, say, multiple horses in the race, all of which have been watched by that person, and all of which had varying degrees of run previously of influencing their horse. Now, being able to put all of that together, being able to frame the odds, if you can say, well, this horse is going to be underbet because of this, and I feel that this horse is going to be overbet because of that, and all of these things link into various races that they've watched over the preceding 6 months, whatever it may be, then you can get a fairly clear picture of the person's thought process. You can see why these might behave that way. Now, of course, everyone always says, oh, well, you know, surely all this stuff is in the price. You can get caught up in this, to be honest. It's tempting sometimes to say everything's in the price because we've all, you know, you'll hear a lot of people trot out the all markets tend to efficiency. That's an episode almost in and of itself, my discussion about that. But, you know, let's take it as largely true. And it's easy to say that, you know, unless I get to bet very, very early, that the information that I have, surely someone else is going to pick up, having watched all these other people who are involved in the market. There'll be plenty of other people who've watched every single race. Well, you know, a really good judge will have not only picked up things that maybe other good watchers haven't seen, but they'll know how to evaluate the combination of all those different interpretations, all those different runs they've seen of those horses. And it's that almost running the race in your head in advance. So people will almost have a speed map of sorts. They'll almost be able to see the race play out. And it's quite powerful visually to have watched so many races to then be able to think through in your own head how you think the race is going to be run. And that visualizing of how you think the race is going to be run, if you're a very good watcher of horse racing, can almost certainly be, you know, you can be superior to the market doing that. I do think that, you know, horse racing is one of those things where plenty of people who watch a lot of racing, and then there's only so many people who then can apply that knowledge or what they've seen to then an individual horse in the betting market, and then very small percentage of people who can then apply all that knowledge collectively into a full race market. However, you know, I think it's very possible to discern from people describing that mental process whether it's possible. There can be other things that just completely, going to another sport, just completely sway me. In that, I remember speaking to someone who'd studied extensively at university sports science, and particularly rugby, and I'd done some rugby trading myself, and everyone always knew the importance of scrummaging, of, you know, ball control packs, lineouts, and so on. But they said how this is going quite a way back now. It's more sort of common knowledge, but a good 10 years or so, how people were becoming more and more conscious of the importance of territory kicking out of hand, which I kind of, you know, you could see the way the game was going with the amount of kicking out of hand that was going on and the efforts to sort of gain the maximum amount of yardage out of it. But also he placed huge emphasis on lineouts. He said that lineouts are one of those things which can often decide games. Now, that at the time to me, certainly when I was younger, and of course, you know, I was of the tendency to scream at the television when trading constantly that the line out was never thrown in straight and all the rest of it. You know, I said, well, I can see how it's important. But he said, no, he said he equated it to NFL turnovers. Now, turnovers are sort of almost impossible to predict, but you do know that those people who turn over the ball less will do better in a season than those who turn over the ball more will do much worse. And he said stealing another team's lineout is hugely impactful and general lineout performance. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, you know, that may be worth evaluating. And then I heard that Steve Borthwick, who was a true expert of the lineout, had been recruited specifically, I believe it was for the Japan national team, just to coach lineouts. I think at the time I was even quite surprised. I knew there'd be forwards coaches, obviously, but to have someone whose sole job was to coach lineouts. And then it started to crystallize for me that this person knew an awful lot about the sport, probably more than I, at a deeper level than I did. And he had not only evaluated through the research he'd done and through other people's research how important the lineouts were, but he had also made the transition to translate how much of a difference to a handicap, superiority, you know, you'd evaluate teams' quality of lineout and how much difference that would make to his handicap line. So there was a classic example of someone who used sports knowledge and used that sports knowledge to impact the way they compiled odds, and consequently was very successful, certainly at that time, rugby better. So while it was sort of almost a bit posthumously that I realized that this person had been quite the judge on this area, I certainly meant going forward, I would never discount information that comes from coaches. Because so you always, the tendency to think is that you know, former professionals, when you hear them on television or coaches, you often think to yourself, well, they come out with so many cliches and platitudes and so on that they really don't understand how actually betting would work. But then there's the people who don't have any TV agenda, and maybe they're just working with teams closely, and they maybe have certainly information that is very predictive of team success. And of course, ultimately, when we're betting, we're trying to evaluate a team or an individual's chance of success, and that then obviously can translate into betting success. So evaluating sports knowledge, in this case, it was the person's background and their access to data that wasn't certainly available to me, wasn't very much in the public arena. I have since seen academic white papers on subjects of lineouts, and territory kicking and so on, which have sort of backed these things up. But yes, for me, it was, you know, in future, it meant that I was more open to these kind of things and how, you know, a judge of sport knowledge could be found through an academic sphere and that kind of research. So that would be one, you know, that's some ways to evaluate a judge of sport knowledge. Coaching, you know, can again crop up elsewhere. I spoke to a golf coach, for example, who spoke extensively on his way of betting on golf, which sounded utterly ridiculous at the time to me. But he said that all the best ball strikers in the world generated an enormous amount of lag in their swing. If you don't know golf, lag is the difference between when the wrists reach the point where the ball is at address, so the ball's generally roughly between the middle of your feet, and your hands will reach where the ball is before the club head does. So that's the lag, the time or the distance between where the club head is and where you've already managed to get your hands through to, through rotating your body. And his example was, I think some of the greatest lag generated was Tiger Woods, but people like Sergio Garcia. And he had access to a load of video footage of different golfers' swings. And he had a calculation for how much lag they would generate. And he just basically bet fairly blindly those people who he knew and had worked with, but who had incredible lags generated. Interestingly enough, one of the, I think, the greatest lags, and you can see it from his wrist positions, actually, if you ever see it slowed down, but one of the greatest lags generated currently in golf is Dustin Johnson. Now, I wouldn't advocate any blind backing strategies, but he showed me the list of players that he pretty much blindly backed. And he generally would back the top three in his list each week. But miraculously, for someone who had no knowledge of betting markets, I'm pretty sure he's the kind of person who'd maybe have only one betting account even. He actually managed to turn a little bit of profit over this. And it came out of just, you know, sporting knowledge. So when I'm judging in that person, I can't think of that person as a judge in the betting sense, but they've gone out of their way to evaluate sporting success from a sports knowledge perspective. And so immediately I'm thinking the fact that you have drilled into the finer metrics of what makes someone successful, you know, huge amounts done in baseball, sabermetrics, or now football metrics and so on. That evaluation, that thinking of the sport at a level that's beyond just the commentator's level of thinking, kind of stuff that you hear on Sky, that automatically gets my ears pricked up, because it's possible that they can be extra good at evaluating a sport. And in turn, if they can then turn that to betting evaluation, phenomenal. But if they can't, even that can be worthwhile, because, you know, if you can predict who's going to be better than the rest, using something that no one else is using, quite often an edge to be found there. Okay, so that's that. That's judge of sport knowledge. Judge of market knowledge. Now, the first thing I would say about evaluating market knowledge is that I would discount anyone almost straight away who uses the words always or never about odds. This is something that we are guilty of, even if we do know that we're doing it. But such and such is always too big, or such and such is always too short, or never big enough price, or, you know, these kind of things, they don't help anyone. They're almost certainly incorrect. It's very hard to think of an instance where the odds have not been correct in both, you know, in one direction consistently on a sporting event for all time. But, you know, I get often we use these as emphasis, but if you find someone who is enthusiastically telling you, you know, AP McCoy was never value to back ever because it was AP McCoy and, you know, the general betting public always made the price too short. Well, I mean, that just can't be right. You know, there's almost certainly were times where, you know, the horses that AP McCoy was on were value to back. And while you get the kernel of what the person's saying behind it, if they can't actually evaluate that further than just always too short, then they're not really judging it adequately. You know, if you then said this particular combination of trainer and jockey, historically, you know, the price always comes in dramatically. Again, you've said always comes in. You want people to say the vast majority of the time, or mostly. I know it's a small thing in language, but mostly this jockey and this trainer combination is, tremendously popular at Cheltenham, and the consequence is that a large amount of money late on will come for those pairings a lot of the time, and a lot of the time the odds will be pushed shorter than their true odds. those kind of people need to sort of temper people need to very much when it comes to talking about markets need to temper their sort of binary discussions of, you know, it's always zero or it's always one. I would say that market knowledge, I would always want someone who can talk in terms of evaluating how a market is going to move. So if someone can tell me that generally, you know, the market in, let's take soccer, for example, football, for example, we're going to talk about the English Premier League, and someone who can tell me who the initial people who go up with odds in Asia first are and how much their limits are when they first open, what's the tendency in terms of, you know, historically, which teams over the past 4 weeks have, you know, had their prices shorten, when the limits tend to go up, who you can expect to see dramatic moves in the half an hour before kickoff, potentially if there is, you know, large liabilities coming in from the agents in Asia just before kickoff, these kind of things. Anyone who can show me an in-depth knowledge from sort of conception of market all the way to kickoff or to the start time. The same with, you know, horse racing. If I can hear someone who can explain to me the evaluation of everything from, you know, the overnight recreational bookmaker horse racing price, you know, how does Bet365's overnight horse racing prices behave? I don't need someone just to tell me they're rubbish and that they're easy to beat. What I need is someone who says, you know, can tell me, oh, do you know that they always pretty much deliberately in maidens go up, looking at my statistics, you know, 70% of the time, the favorites in 2-year-old maidens go off, this many ticks shorter than their opening price at Bet365. They're happy to get them in the book or seemingly the people who compile their tissue, you know, however bad it may be. That sort of seems to be the attitude. That little piece of market knowledge I always find interesting. I always like to try and, you know, assess the psychology behind it. If that person has spoken to someone then at Bet365 and knows the reasoning behind it, so much the better. How the odds maybe behave in that first half an hour after the shops open, and you get some of the more optimistic runners going into those shops, and then maybe, you know, when the Betfair market now forms, you know, once upon a time Betfair market used to form much earlier, but you know, what they expect to see happen at 11 at midday, 15 minutes before the off, what they think the SP is going to do. People who can digest to me not just it's going to shorten or I can see it drifting, people who can actually assess where they think the money's going to go, how it's going to go, telling the entire narrative of the market journey, those people I instantly will be thinking in, you know, more serious judge terms than someone who can just talk in very general sweeping statements. It's of course quite hard to be a complete expert on odds movements and where they're going to go, but you know, like I say, there's going to be a select few people who are very good at it, and those are the ones that we want to be talking to and getting advice from. Evaluating when a move is just because an odds move is just because of recreational money versus when it might be sharp money, or when it can be because of a certain, even something like recreational books, you know, knowing that certain bookmakers will always push out their odds on a certain morning of the race, morning of the tournament, whatever, in this fashion, because part of the marketing push for them is to always get the front, you know, X teams, players in the book. You know, it doesn't have to be just, you know, knowledge of how Betfair behaves potentially or how the Asian market behaves. I'm always fascinated by people who have little insights into the way the recreational bookmakers operate and how they work. And, you know, it's always particularly handy to have conversations with any people who have worked for those bookmakers and see if you can discern where these patterns come from. that market knowledge really requires, I think, evaluating other ones, someone else's market knowledge requires largely to have some market knowledge yourself. And with that regard, I'm afraid market knowledge is only really gained. You know, you can listen to other people talk about it, you know, but it really requires you to watch odds a lot. A lot of people will find it quite boring, but noting down opening prices, noting down closing prices, watching the market before events start, all these kind of things allow you to better understand how markets work. And the more you understand market works, the better you can then become at executing your bets, which is going to be the fourth section of the judge evaluation. But yeah, market knowledge, I think you need the market knowledge to be able to provide a frame of reference for your sporting knowledge or for your stats modeling. And when you've got good market knowledge, you can then vastly improve your execution. So definitely something worth doing. And when once, you know, you can then spot if someone is saying like, oh, so-and-so always shortens in the betting, you'll be able to go, oh, do you know what? Actually, I was watching that the other day on Betfair and it drifted like a barge. And immediately you've then got a slight bullshit detected setting for yourself. So yeah, there's no shortcuts in instantly thinking to yourself, oh, you know, that sounds like the truth or rubbish when it comes to market knowledge. You do need some of your own. Whereas with sports knowledge, I think evaluating that can be a little bit easier because you can almost do it by omission, in that if someone gives you a little bit of information about a sport that you've never heard anyone else say, and it passes sort of your basic understandings when you assess it of the sport, then it's certainly there's a good chance that, you know, the information could be of merit and that then you can use it and that person may know what they're talking about. Obviously, people might just make something up completely. But, you know, I've got to assume that anything that you've decided that you're interested in betting in, hopefully you have some interest in the sport and therefore you can do some evaluation about whether what the person says about that sport is likely to be true or not. But market knowledge, you know, most of us don't have inherent market knowledge. You know, it's no one grows up as a child watching odds for fun, unlike maybe playing the sport. So, yeah, I'm afraid you just got to get that by grinding out, watching and recording markets as much as you can. Right. So moving on to the judge of stats and modeling, how to evaluate that. Now, this initially can feel very hard to people because a lot of, you know, not a huge amount of us have high level statistical backgrounds or particularly very knowledgeable about coding or mathematics in general. So it can be quite hard to evaluate content online or wherever it may be and know, you know, a lot of people putting their models out there in the public domain. You know, you can't just say just because it's free, it must be rubbish. This certainly is not true. There have been some incredible models left for free online over the years, which a lot of people have dismissed as just, you know, another something that someone's just putting out on the internet for fun. And there are other people who've looked at it, they've evaluated it and thought, this is really on. I'm going to just try having a few quid on this, and it's turned out to be immensely profitable. So we can't use being behind a paywall or, you know, whether it's free or not as a way of evaluating the quality online of stats modeling work. And when you speak to someone, it's quite easy for someone to confuse you when speaking to them about how smart they are about the stats modeling as well. You know, if someone says, oh, I've got an advanced machine learning algorithm using neural networks, random forests, all these other sort of, you know, buzzwords, well, not buzzwords, but, you know, you can string a whole load of technical words and techniques together and you're thinking, my God, just mortgage my house right now and, you know, get the lot on whatever this guy's doing. And you just can't do that because there are some people who are doing quite smart mathematical things without even knowing the names of the techniques they're doing. Rare, but, you know, there can be that. But also there are a lot of people who've just picked up bits and pieces, they've cobbled them all together and, you know, spat them out. And, you know, there's money to be made in just sounding competent about something or selling snake oil. So you do need to be a bit more critical. It's very, you know, people almost fall over themselves. Not so much now, actually, people are getting a bit wiser, but I remember once upon a time to be able to say, he's got a model or they've got a model, everyone be suddenly like, oh my God, they've got a model. And, you know, they're not, these boys aren't just, you know, plucking numbers out of air. You know, they've actually got something that predicts the future, which can be, you know, not necessarily true. So how do we go about evaluating it if we're not necessarily from a statistical background? Well, I like to know where people have got their data from. If someone says, oh, you know, I paid for a media subscription to Opta or whatever it was, I took the last 10 years of Opta data, already I'm thinking, oh, okay, right, okay, so it's from Opta, the data has been presumably cleaned reasonably well by them, you know, well looked after, you know, already I'm feeling more confident in what's to come. If the person just said, oh, I just scraped off the website of, you know, the Premier League website, some stats for last season, you're thinking, oh, okay, doesn't seem like much data. Believe me, when someone tells you how much data they've used, absolutely there is, you know, data does become too old and less relevant. Generally, I would say the more the better. It really is, because someone who models well, their model will filter out the data, you know, they'll scale, the time decay will kick into their model. And so even if they had 20 years worth of data, the model may only be using the last 2 years. It doesn't hurt, you know, nothing goes wrong if you're modeling correctly and having all that data in the database. If anything, it allows you to take back testing more seriously, in that you can take a chunk out of it for training a model and then another chunk out of it that the model hasn't been trained on to test the model on. So having a lot of data is not a problem. So I like to hear someone have plenty of data. I like someone to have, you know, decent quality of data. You know, I mean, great example, you know, we've got fabulous data resource for both tennis and football in Joseph Bukdal's football data and tennis data websites. However, he's only one man. He does an awful lot of work. And there's every chance that in those spreadsheets somewhere, one of those numbers could be off. So I like to know if someone's done their due diligence. So, for example, if you go through Joseph's sheet and you turn all the bookmakers' odds, say, into percentages, you might find there's suddenly a batch of games where it all adds up to 50%. You're thinking, well, no bookmaker probably actually put out a load of odds that added up to 50%. So, you know, arguably there's a chance that that's nonsense. So, and it's not, I would say, there's no fault of Joseph's here. You know, there's awful lot to keep on top of and so on. But it's going through, you know, Opta sell data for as a, you know, as for a living. So they do this cleaning of data, making sure it's optimal. Joseph's got a job, I imagine, you know, and a life. He can do a lot, but he's still putting out a lot of information for free. So it's impossible to demand of him that everything is perfectly 100% accurate all the time, as much as he will try to do so. So I like to hear people say that they have cleaned up the data, they've inspected the data, make sure, because the, you know, the more data you have and the higher grade of the data, the better the model can be. Right, so that all sounds very boring, but, you know, and it may seem weird if you're asking someone who says they've got a model about these things, but they should be, if they're someone who enjoys the modeling process, should be happy to talk about where they get the data from and how they've ensured the quality of it. You want to know how easy to access that data is. If someone tells you that they're building a model for football just using, you know, goals scored home and away by the teams, well, you know, that information is obviously widely available to everyone. So you're not going to get, your edge will not come from having data that no one else does. I ought to add, though, everyone seems to think that that is where the edge only can come from. How people handle data and assess the data, because a lot of people think there's only one way to statistically analyze a set of data that's accurate. And while there are definitely ways that are better than others, different people can apply slightly different filters or tweaks to that. And, you know, there is a wide difference in performance of a model built just using goals scored home and away between the worst treatment of all that data and the very best treatment of all that data. You know, how far to look back with that data, which matches to include and which matches not to include, all these things. But by and large, if someone's using data that is really easy to get and has been around forever, you're going to be thinking, well, you know, I don't know how much of a, you know, a judge quality product is going to come out of that. So more complex, so we've got a lot of data, we've got clean data, we've got complex data that's hard to get hold of. All these things are getting you thinking, you know, the output of this could be very good. And then the modeling. Now, if you'd never done any modeling yourself or had any great interest in it, this can be tough. I would say, again, I've said this in various blogs, actually I've written in various pieces I've done over the years, the internet is filled with almost every clever betting idea that's been had. It really is. And invariably, and I've worked in, you know, syndicates, bookmakers who, you know, have built models, and you ask them, you know, where did the, you know, how did you come up with this? And while often in any given sport, there is only so many ways to actually produce an implied probability, you know, I mean, putting team A's, you know, predicting how many goals team A is going to score and team B is going to score in a football match and combining them, you know, that sort of doesn't really change so much. But the first ever interpretation of it, someone will say, oh, well, I read Dixon and Cole's paper, 1980, whenever it is, maybe earlier. And then Dixon and Cole's themselves actually wrote subsequent papers to improve upon it. And then, you know, it goes on and on. And this information is all out there. Almost every sport, you know, from Aussie rules to, you know, rugby league to golf to tennis to American football, you name it, someone has written a paper for their university for it. Now, again, all that information about stats and the data, apply that when you read a white paper online. These papers are almost always available for free somewhere or at a very small cost if you subscribe to sort of the deposit, you know, JSTOR, these kind of places which have these papers. But it really is as simple as starting by Googling, you know, predictive model for tennis or some such. And every time I find a new one, I save them and go through them and sort of pick apart. And you'll notice a great consistency of models. You know, there'll be one, two, three models. And what's fabulous is every so often, every few years, someone writes a paper comparing the three different models that have come up so far and how predictive they are. And then, you know, that research will get refreshed. So there's constantly a way for you to become aware, because I guarantee you that, you know, if you're sat there thinking, oh, I don't know how these really smart people do this, chances are they're using something they have initially started with from a resource like this. Very few people just sit down, having never thought about how to model football before, and just think, well, how would I do it? It'd be fabulous if more people did do this. But fortunately for us, you know, a lot of this stuff is already been around for a long time, and you can even trace the, you know, the evolution of these models. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to read some of these. Now, they'll do a fabulous thing where the introduction will be all text, and you'll think, yeah, I'm fine with this. I got what the premise is. You'll read the conclusion. That's all text. And you think, yeah, I get that. And then in between that, there'll be walls of text interspersed with complex equations, and you'll think, I just don't get that. And the other thing is poorly formatted tables where you're trying to scan along and see what line is that outcome from, you know, multiple decimal places. They can be a nightmare to digest, but a really good paper will help you understand the information. So there was a tremendously old horse racing paper written, I think it was Australia based. So you had to immediately put your head in the, you know, Australian racing's not like British racing, you know, there's no heavy ground at Foss-Last style scenario. You know, tracks are very, have a lot of similarities, not very similar, I should say, but have a lot of similarities, the same sort of surfaces that they run on. And this person put in a load of factors as to what was the most predictive outcome, what was the most predictive metric for predicting success in horse racing. And I believe the, you know, you had loads of different parameters, and the one that came out head and shoulders above the rest was the speed rating, or the time the horse had done in its previous, I think it was four starts. It was established four starts. And this paper's old as the hills. And you read it and you think, right, so lots of horses running over similar surfaces, quite easy to get quite a good speed rating. And what was interesting was it put in a ranking, and the ranking for speed last time out for the horses was quite low down. But the average speed across four races, the last four races out, so immediately you're like, right, okay, so what am I drawing from this? Okay, so a horse that has one exceptional run last time out, that doesn't predict so well. And you're thinking to yourself, well, that's also what most Joe Public are going to see, right? This horse did really bloody well last time out. However, the horse that does well on average across several runs, so the consistent performing horse, that is more predictive. And you know, do a little off the top of your head bullshit test. Well, you know, it sounds plausible. So there you are. Now you'll look through the processes and you might hear ways that they evaluated the predictiveness of these things. Put them into Wikipedia, the techniques. Again, there's going to be equations. You might not get it all, but at least try and evaluate what the technique is trying to do. Make sure the technique even exists. You know, if you go on Wikipedia straight away, you look up Brier score or something like that, and you're like, oh, okay, that thing does exist. And I can see the description at least tells me what it's trying to do, even if I don't understand the maths. So we're going to get as many papers as we can. We're going to try and Google and Wikipedia as many of the technical terminologies we can, compare and contrast all of these papers we have over one sport. Now, if you're then speaking to someone and none of these words or methods or techniques crock up, alarm bells start ringing. At least if they don't say, well, I tried doing a Pythagorean model, or I tried doing one of these other models, didn't work for me, I went on to this. If they just randomly came up with a model that no one else tried for, you really do have to be immediately skeptical, because like I say, so much in sports betting and modeling has already been done. The devil is in the detail. They may say, oh, I took, you know, a sort of a classic LO model, and the K factor, I massively tweaked the K factor. You can look all this up. You know, K factor for this particular division or this type of football, it made all the difference. You're like, oh, right, okay, now that makes sense. But, you know, if someone says, oh, I've got this brilliant way that rates two teams out of 10, and then, you know, I just, you know, add them together and divide by two or whatever, you've got to be immediately thinking, well, I'm not so sure about that. So, again, much like market knowledge, there's no real shortcut. You've got to familiarize yourself with the academic world for these things. And then immediately, once you have familiarized yourself with these things, you can go on something like, what's a good example of a nice website? Club Elo. So this is a really great site put together, which does Elo ratings for all the different, for a lot of European leagues. And it's tracked them for, you know, it's using data back to the 60s. In fact, only a league is only added when he can get enough data for it through. And I don't think, you know, it's necessary, you know, you're not going to make money by betting the overlays of the predictions here per se. You know, there can be angles to be found. But brilliantly, this website has listed the system. So the system, how it works, tells you the equation, tells you the adjustments they made to the standard equation, how they evaluated goal difference, how they evaluated field advantage, you know, all these things. It's nicely there. Some academic papers actually listed there as well. Brilliant. Immediately, I'm sold that while, you know, these kind of rating systems, the world's come along, you know, we're doing player-based models in football with, you know, really in-depth data, I can say this is going to be a real good, solid, you know, vanilla entry-level prediction for football match outcome. The kind of thing which, if I was doing my own model from scratch, I could reference and see what someone else, so I've done Man United, Chelsea, or let's see what, that website's got. And I can trust what that website's got in that it will systematically have done the same process over and over again. That process is pretty sound. There are other people who've then, funnily enough, evaluated websites like European Club Index, Club Elo, and so on. And they've evaluated how accurate their predictions are. Yeah, the predictions aren't too bad. They're not as good as the closing line, bookmaking line, but, they're not too far away. So you're thinking, right, okay, so they're not too far away from the closing. So maybe they're even better than the opening in some leagues. You never know. You can get thinking like this. But you can also think that if it's reasonably predictive, then it's something that you can compare your own models at. Anyway, diverged away there. But certainly, whenever I'm speaking to someone evaluating their model, I like to hear, because I try to read as much as I can all the time, I like to hear basically different takes on storied examples. And immediately I'm thinking to myself, right, so that person's, done the same investigations that I have, except they're trying to improve upon it. Already I'm thinking, yep, this is going up in my judge estimation. So that is how I would advise judging a judge in that regard. You will maybe occasionally have instances where someone has done something that evaluates a sport in a way that you've never thought of before. I would say in that situation, is it using data that wasn't available before? So, for example, if someone is using shots data in a completely different way for a league that, to your knowledge, there never has been easily available shots data for, I don't know, Vietnamese second league, whatever it may be, then maybe you can be thinking, oh, well, maybe they've come up with something different. But chances are, because we've had shots data for all these other leagues for 70 years, probably isn't something new or different. Or it's certainly not going to be good. But, let's say, what's going to be, if we suddenly had a lot of, football's not so easy, but if we got far greater meter coverage for rugby statistics, so they've currently a lot of rugby, professional rugby teams for training and so on, and even professional games will have trackers built into the shirts or into some sort of piece of kit attached to the players. That data has not come out into the public domain that much. If suddenly a whole slew of performance data, athletic-based performance data came out for rugby, and instead of, sort of power rankings and, handicap ratings and these kind of things, if someone suddenly said, actually, I've created an entire model just off ball possession time and it's adjusted, the ball possession time is adjusted for field position, I'd be like, okay, well, I can instantly see that that's something that maybe the world hasn't had access to. Plus, there's not a very large amount of money, options for professional syndicates and bettors to bet on rugby. So, you can believe not as much effort has gone into the modeling of it. But yeah, by and large, the rules I've mentioned in evaluating how likely someone is to be having an edge and doing a model that's got any merit stand pretty much. And so finally, we have the judge of execution. And the judge of execution is, everyone's got to have a certain degree to be successful, a certain degree of expertise in how to get on. This is one where just talking to people about their experiences of getting on and how they've tried to get their bets on, the experience of when they place their bets and in order to get met on. This is more sort of, I think, feel for people. Understand that if anyone is successful, it is hard to get bets down, and if maybe they're betting purely on sort of football Asian handicaps, maybe, you may be thinking, well, you can get down in size. They should still have some thoughts on, which broker they use. Do they use a, Skype platform? Do they use an actual sort of piece of software? Do they speak to some guy out in the jungle in Malaysia or whatever on a mobile phone that they got told about from someone who worked at the Hong Kong Jockey Club? I don't know what, they should have some explanation of thought process that goes beyond just, well, I come up with a number and I just go on Odds Checker and have as much money as where I can. Because straight away you're thinking, right, well, if you can be using bookmakers and Odds Checker, How are you using that? Do you have access to other people's accounts? Again, I can't, you know, on my podcast also, I can't condone the use of accounts that are not in your name. But, you know, of course, it does go on. And people have wide and varied ways of acquiring those accounts. We're not talking just, you know, friends and family here. We're talking quite elaborate operations that will get accounts to be opened for, you know, in third parties. How do they do the admin of that? You know, you've got someone else with a betting account that's got a lot of money in. How do you ensure that you get the money? These may sound like utter mundanities, but believe me, once you've established an edge, it's this kind of crap, unfortunately, that, you know, is what consumes people. And one of the many reasons amongst others, and I'm not very bright, but one of the many reasons why I would struggle ever to be a particularly successful or professional gambler is because so much of this admin of getting on is brutal, because you either need to get an edge that's good enough to beat liquid smart markets, Betfair and the like, or you need to be utterly dedicated to getting on. So when speaking to someone who's got an edge, if they're not struggling to get on in the size that they want, you can straight away question about how much of a judge they are. Not entirely fair. You know, there are plenty of people who will be very smart about betting and who bet in fivers and tenners. In fact, there are some people who are very smart about betting who don't even bet. I know that sounds odd, but it is true. I have met people who've built, you know, fabulous models. Nothing recently, I have to say, but in years gone by, fabulous models that, you know, absolutely, they tested against the betting markets, not with their own money, just with recording it, you know, and they absolutely beat the market senseless. And they took great pride in just building a model that outperformed one of the best predictors of outcomes in the betting markets. And that was that. So, you know, you can't totally guarantee execution. Although I will say, you know, by and large, Taleb is, you know, very big advocate of this, but skin in the game, in life in general, if you don't have skin in the game, your opinion becomes of less merit. I kind of buy into that, to be honest. Certainly, if ever I spoke to a judge and I've basically discerned whether their edge came from sport knowledge, market knowledge, or modeling knowledge, if they then told me all that, or I'd evaluated them as being smart, and they then didn't have a penny on it, I'd want to know how do they really know that it made money. If you haven't actually gone through the process and actually tested the realities, or it turns out you can't get on this size, or you can't get on when you need to get on, or these kind of things, if they haven't gone through that process, it's hard to know really how good it is. And on top of that, also, they need to sort of go through the, I like to know that people have gone through the emotions of placing bets, and that sort of can tell you, you know, Being a genuine judge, someone who bets successfully, is a matter of, you know, discipline and, you know, psychological fortitude, if you like. You know, so I wouldn't be able to know how strong someone was in those regards. Those aren't things that they can necessarily give you, unfortunately. I wish someone could give me some of those, you know, make me more disciplined just by telling me or giving me a portion of their discipline or those kind of things. But certainly in evaluating the whole package. So, you know, if someone can tell you, you know, they went through 6 months without making a penny, and then 12 months before they were back to break even, and that was 5 years ago, and they still carried on betting since then, since they made plenty of money, whatever, you know, we joke, I think a lot of professional gamblers joke about bad beat stories, and you get a group of serious gamblers together, and you'd be hard-pushed to believe that anyone makes any fucking money at all, because they'll all just be moaning about how terrible their luck is and what a terrible run they're on. But this is sort of almost a bizarre professional gambler humility that not all possess, but a lot of the times you sort of experience it. But there's not as much ego to be derived from telling people that you went through a long period of not making any money and came out the other side. I don't think there's much point in lying about it too much. So to hear these things and people tell you how they got through them, that again is like just another tick box for me that, all right, someone who can go through that and you know, came out the other side, that is a good sign. But yeah, you know, like I say, there's the evaluating how clever someone's execution is often quite simple, really. You know, if people say, oh, I found that, you know, I was always getting accounts closed because of X, and I figured out that if I, you know, all these old things that people love to think are the be-all and end-all, like I found out that if I played in the casino for an hour a day online, then the accounts lasted longer, whatever. You know, some things that, you know, may or may not work, or all this, but there's people who are willing to even talk about those things that they've tried. The fact that they're trying that means that they're trying to keep accounts open. They're trying to keep accounts open means that they've had accounts closed. If they've had accounts closed, they must be doing something at least partially intelligent, although you can get closed seemingly for nothing, of course, and you can get closed simply because you place bets at the same time as a load of other people who are already deemed smart, but you can at least console yourself with the fact that you are doing something smart at the same time as other smart people. Although only as smart as that bookmaker has deemed them. So judge of execution, I think, really is, it's just about understanding how much of a struggle that person's gone through and what ways have they thought to go around it. You know, quite often you'll meet, you probably won't meet them because you don't hang around the same kind of people as me necessarily if you're listening to this, but there'll be people who you hear about or you meet who had a great edge, couldn't get on, don't bother anymore. Well, there's always a way to get on. I mean, some of them may be really annoying, painful, partially illegal, you know, whatever it may be. But if you've got a way of making money that you've decided to give up, maybe a bit harsh to not call them, say that they're not a judge. But, you know, the true judge will find a way to get on, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Certainly if they're a good judge of execution, they'll just take it as part of the overall challenge and find a way to get by. Right, I feel like I've talked for ages now, and I'm very thirsty, consequently. So I'm going to leave it there. I must apologize. I'm trying desperately to get these up on other platforms other than Anchor. I think Stitcher is available, which I think some people use, and Pocket Cast, which I myself use to listen to podcasts, is available. And hopefully it will get on iTunes, obviously it'll be handy, and Google and so on. And also, much to my chagrin, I appear to have published the episodes in a cack-handed way. So I think the episode 1 now comes after episodes 2 and 3. I am trying to fix that. But yeah, so they're called episodes 1, 2, and 3. So hopefully you'll know just to listen to them in the correct order, or at least listen to the introduction one before the others. Right, I hope that hasn't been too droney for you. I hope you've enjoyed some of that, and I hope that's good enough for you for now. A lucky day is definitely a subject I could come back and visit some more, and I hope you all enjoyed it.